Welcome to We Mentor Mondays podcast with Nancy. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery. Learn something new from our stories today. Well, welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy. Our guest today is Stevie Ray. He's a corporate speaker and trainer across the country for over 25 years and co-founder of Stevie Ray's Improv Company in Minneapolis. He's a nationally syndicated columnist for the Business Journal newspapers and is the author of 9 books, including Quick Thinking for Any Situation, The Calm Before the Brainstorm, and Speaking in Public Without Sweating in Private. You can also order these books if you go to the WeMentor.com website. I'm an affiliate with Amazon, and you can get a 20% discount for his books. His books have been read by nearly every member of his family.
I'm quite proud.
Okay, that's very good. You couldn't quite get everybody, but you know, that's the norm.
Still working on mom.
Yeah. So in addition to his work in the corporate world, Stevie's a professional entertainer and has performed with such stars as Paula Poundstone and Weird Al Yankovic. I love Weird Al Yankovic. He must have been quite a a personality to kind of work with.
Oh, yes, he was.
Just a brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of skit did you do with him, or how did
that? I opened for his show at the State Theater in downtown Minneapolis, and then I did another show with him up at the Entertainment Center in Duluth. So I was his opening act.
Okay. Oh, excellent. So how long was he doing his act?
He was doing one-nighters around the country,
okay.
Doing the big theaters and going from place to place.
So you were traveling with him?
No, they hire different people who are local because that saves on cost.
Okay.
And the producer heard about me and called up and said, would you like to be his opening act for here? And it worked so well. They said, you want to go up to Duluth? But if he's going to go into Denver or Miami, they're just going to hire a local performer there.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Sure. And isn't Paula Poundstone kind of a regular on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
She's on NPR now.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow. And how did you meet her?
I was for a short time in my career, I did the road, as they say, in stand-up comedy. And so I always knew that I wanted to include that in my career, but I didn't want it to be a focus of what I did. I didn't want to be just a comedian.
Yeah.
And so that was during that 3-year period when I was on the road, and I happened to perform at a club in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And one of the gentlemen in the audience said, I'm part owner of a club in Chicago and I like you. Do you want to come down and perform there? And so I was an opening act for Paula Poundstone for a week down there.
Oh.
That's kind of how that world works.
Okay.
Is you run into somebody
really
who knows somebody.
World. Yeah, right.
Yep.
Very cool. And you're also a beekeeper?
Yes. Yeah. I like to, I produce and sell a brand called Steve's Bees Minnesota Honey.
Oh, yes. Steve's Bees Minnesota Honey.
Mm-hmm. So it's the natural raw honey right out of the comb.
Yeah.
So it's not heat processed like you buy in the store.
Yeah.
So it's better for you.
I see.
Heat processing is done by commercial honey operations. All that does is keep it liquid and it never crystallizes.
Yeah.
And sometimes people get a little weirded out when they see crystallized honey. They actually think it's spoiling and going bad.
Yeah.
When actually honey can't go bad. It's called the world's perfect food because it can never spoil. As long as you keep it tightly.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, if the lid is tight.
Yeah.
If you leave it open, it'll absorb moisture from the atmosphere and then ferment and become what is known as mead. That's what the Vikings would drink for an alcoholic drink. But if you seal it up, pardon me, they have pulled vases of honey out of Egyptian tombs that are 1,000 years old, and it's still fine. But some people like it liquid all the time, so it's heat treated. But that also kills all the nutrients. So what you're buying in the store is no different chemically than sugar water.
Okay.
Real honey that is raw and unprocessed has all of the antioxidants and things like that that are good for you.
So how do people get a hold of you? Do they? So you sell it direct?
I sell it direct. People go to my Facebook page.
Okay.
And Steve's Bees. I also sell it out of a few stores if I have a good enough stock. And I have private customers.
Okay.
That will buy it literally by the gallon.
That's nice. Excellent. Well, already learning a ton about you. you and I met, you came in and did, when I was running workshops at the Marsh, you did an improv class
right.
with my group.
Yes.
Yeah. And I just clearly remember yes and instead of no but.
Oh, good. You remember the rule.
The rule. And I use it all the time.
Improvisation has an interesting history because it started in many different places around the globe, roughly at the same time. And none of them knew of what the other was doing. So a lot of people think of it purely as an entertainment, style.
Yeah, I did.
And it was, used for that in many cases, but it was also developed as a communication tool. As a training tool, one woman who's considered one of the mothers of improvisation is Viola Spolin, and she was working in Chicago in the 30s, and she was in charge of running workshops and classes for various groups, and sometimes it would be children, and she taught them theater. But to help them learn how to communicate.
Yeah.
She was also working with the immigrant populations back then in Chicago. You had German, Polish, and Italians moving into the United States during the 30s. They were having trouble getting jobs because of communication barriers. So she would run workshops organized through the WPA, Roosevelt's Economic Recovery Program, the Works Progress Administration. And they had cultural centers where people could take classes.
Oh.
And so she was teaching workshops there as well. So it had a whole different approach than just doing comedy or performing.
Yeah.
And she started creating games in order to achieve an objective. And so the games had what she called a point of concentration or a point of focus to them, which meant if your challenge is this, then let's create a game that deals specifically with just that one challenge. Communication, getting over language barriers, eye contact, all those things that make a person successful in the work world.
Yeah.
And so she used it largely for improving people's lives. Her son, Paul Sills, grew up and would every day after school go to his mother's workshops. And play along with these games.
Oh.
As he grew, he wanted to be an actor and get involved in theater. So after he graduated from the University of Chicago, he and a few other gentlemen founded the Second City Theater. And that is where everybody from Saturday Night Live comes from, is Second City in Chicago. They're a huge improv center in the country. That's where people like Bill Murray and John Belushi and Gilda Radner, they all came from Second City.
Well, is Saturday Night Live kind of the birthplace of improv?
No, it is the child of improv.
Oh, the child.
Yes.
Okay, that's a good way to think about it.
And, I mean, Saturday Night Live draws from Second City and a few other large sources of talent. But Second City was designed in the early days, and still is. Paul Sills wanted to be satirical and make social points and things like that. So they don't perform improv as much as they write sketches. They used improvisational technique for a writing tool. And they would use it to flesh out ideas and to come up with new concepts and things like that. Then they would turn those into pre-scripted material and perform those sketches on stage. But it was later Second City started in 1959. And after a while of performing it, they would say, if you want to stick around after the show, we will show you the games we play that help us come up with our ideas and help us write our material. And that's when they would perform improv. And originally in the early days, improvisation was not intended to be its own performance style. It was used as a writing tool and as a training tool. And most actors of any kind today and back then, if you didn't have improv training in your background, you just weren't going to make it because it is a core skill.
Yeah, I can
see
that.
So it eventually became its own thing. People would say, wow, why don't you just perform improv?
Yeah.
And they would say, well, no, we write our sketches and they have a theme and a point to them and all that kind of stuff. But other theaters around the country, like here in the Twin Cities, Dudley Riggs Brave New Workshop. Mm-hmm. And there in Brazil, there was a man named Augusto Boal who used improv as a social commentary tool. A man in England, Keith Johnstone, used improvisation simply to train actors to free up their performance. They did not call it improvisation. They called it improvisatory technique.
Okay.
And then that became popular. So he toured Great Britain and then eventually came to Canada to have his headquarters there. So all these people used improv for different reasons and for different outcomes. Mm. And then it eventually just became its own thing. And Saturday Night Live, when it started, it just happened to be, they were not looking for improv people. They just ended up with them because the producer, Lorne Michaels, already knew Dan Aykroyd and a bunch of other people.
Yeah.
And he liked them and he put them all together and they all had an improv background and they would use it to write the sketches on Saturday Night Live.
Oh.
So almost 100% of the actors on that show have come from an improv background. There are theaters in California called like the Groundlings is a major improv organization in California, Second City in Chicago, Second City in Toronto.
Okay.
Those places all are a feeding ground. And there are a few that did not have improv training, like Eddie Murphy.
Okay.
He came from he was a stand-up.
Yeah.
Who actually got on the show by harassing Lorne Michaels daily until Lorne said, fine, get on the show.
Oh.
Yeah, he would not let go.
Okay. Yes. Perseverance and persistence.
Exactly.
One of the core skills in longevity. Exactly. In the field. Yeah.
But it was Viola Spolin who actually formalized the yes and rule.
Okay.
And it was, in a way, to counter what is commonly called in improvisation, negating.
Okay.
And negating in our world has its own meaning. And it means to shut down what is given to you and not roll with it.
Yeah.
And you see that a lot in beginning training.
Well, I see that a lot when, entrepreneurs and innovators bring their ideas to other people or to the board or make a transition with their strategic plan and they're just shot out of the water.
Exactly.
Like there's no room for even a deeper conversation. They've already made up their mind that that's not right.
And it's interesting because a lot of the work that I do in the training that I offer my corporate clients is based on neuroscience. And what surprised me is the deeper I got into neuroscientific research, the more it was clear that the very things that will help the brain stay vital and active are, they mirror the games played in improvisation.
Okay.
So the brain, in order to stay active and healthy and functional, you have to every now and then do an activity that will wake it up because the brain is very good at narrow focusing. And whatever you do the most of, it focuses on that.
Yeah.
We become specialists, and that's good because we're more productive that way. And it's bad because it shuts off growth, and it's very harmful for when a crucial moment happens and you need to come up with ideas to solve it.
Yeah.
That narrow focus won't help you there.
Sure.
So neurologists have said that you must engage every now and then in what's called whole brain activity. Mm-hmm. And that's when every part of the brain pops open all at once. Now, that's not going to happen all by itself because that uses a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And if there's one thing the brain likes to do, it's conserve energy because it uses 20% of the body's energy output anyway. So if you want to keep your brain healthy, you do a whole brain game every now and then. Mm. The qualities of a whole brain game are exactly the qualities of an improv game.
Oh.
And they were not designed for each other's purpose. Yeah. It just happens to coincide with what we've been doing for generations in improv. Now it's healthy for the brain.
So Viola Spolin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So is she still alive?
No, she passed away. And in fact, her son, Paul Sills, also passed away. Because Viola was working in the 30s as an adult.
Okay. As an adult. Okay. Yep.
And Paul Sills, Oh man, I think it's probably been 10 years now that he's passed away. He passed away in his 80s.
Oh, okay.
But he kept at it for his whole life.
Wow.
After he retired from Second City and passed it on to the next generation, he and his wife and family moved up to Door County, Wisconsin.
Oh yeah.
Where he has a farmhouse with a barn and all the stuff. So he ran workshops for improv professionals. During the summer, he would take only 16 applicants from around the country at a time and put them through a week-long intensive training session. But the big cliche is he did it in his barn.
Yeah.
In the old days, the joke was, I've got a barn, let's build a theater and put on a show. Well, he actually did that. So.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now that we kind of have a little understanding of the improv world and how that has come about and shaped the comedian and acting field, there's enough science now. So it's brought into corporate America as a tool.
Much more so than ever before.
Okay. And it seems to continue to grow.
Yes. My business partner, Pamela Main, and I started Stevie Ray's in 1989. And our focus was, at the time, improv was very much seen only as an acting tool. Comedians in the stand-up world rarely practice improv. And improvers rarely do stand-up. There are a few people like myself who cross over and do both, but it's not very common.
Oh.
Because it is the difference between baking and cooking. Both give you food.
Yeah.
They are done entirely different.
Right.
And
mediums.
There are stand-up comedians who would say, you mean go on stage without anything prepared? Are you crazy?
Yeah.
Because a stand-up comedian, they rework the same material for years to hone it. And they know exactly what they're going to say when they hit that stage.
Yeah.
There's very rarely a thing called an improvisational stand-up comedian. As much as they'd like you to think that, it doesn't happen.
Oh, I thought it would. Wow.
Okay. Even when you watch Robin Williams, very little of what he did was entirely improvisational. It was rehashed over and over and over again and perfected. The gift is to make it seem like it just popped into their mind.
Right.
That's the difficulty of stand-up. Improvisation, an improver might tell you, go on stage all by myself. Are you kidding? Because we work in teams.
Yeah.
There's a pull to either one. And for me, I like both. I've done both for my entire career. Hmm. I couldn't choose which one I would have to choose if I had to.
Okay.
But improvisation was largely seen as an acting training tool and a performance art. My business partner, Pamela, and I said, improv is a life skill. So when we started our company, we did something unusual by saying, we are not going to promote our classes to actors or performing artists. We are going to promote entirely to what we call normal people.
Yeah.
Working folks, people who wanted to use it for personal growth, professional growth, all that kind of thing. So we attracted executives and young employees and people who were shy in social situations and lawyers and doctors and you name it, anybody who had to communicate, especially when it wasn't easy to communicate. And we attracted an entirely different type of person to improv than had ever gone before.
Oh.
And so, and that's what we wanted, was to improve people's lives through improvisation.
Sure.
Many of them discovered that they did have a performing talent and went on to pursue that. And many of them just used it for personal or professional growth. And it was interesting because only a short time into our organization's birth, where we did have performances and we had our school, one of our students, who was an account executive at Cargill, came to me and said, that exercise you taught me last week was really cool. I said, good, glad you liked it. He said, I used it during a conference with my client, and it really helped me deal with a tough situation. I was better able to think on my feet and handle their concerns, and I really appreciate it. I said, good, good, that's a good outcome. And he said, have you ever thought of going to companies directly instead of waiting for individuals to come to your classes? We had not thought of that.
Okay.
And Pamela and I have a one-word business plan for Stevie Ray's improv company. That word is, okay. Somebody comes with an idea, we say, okay.
Yeah.
So we said okay to that idea and thought, yeah. Well, we hadn't thought of going to do workshops for companies, but why not?
Yeah.
So we didn't really know how to approach them because this was such a new thing.
Yeah.
We called up companies and said, hey, we've got these techniques we can teach you. At first, it was a really difficult sell because we used the word improv too much. And improv is a confusing word to a lot of people. Back then, most people still thought it meant stand-up comedy. So okay. People would say, well, we don't need to learn how to be funny.
Yeah.
And we had to convince them. Even in regular improv classes, most people are surprised to find out how little is discussed about comedy or trying to be funny. Anybody who tries to do that fails. 90% of improv training is listening skills. And the other 10% is how to work with a partner.
Sure.
There's your work world.
Yeah.
Listening, communicating, working well with others.
Yeah.
So once we finally got in the door at some companies, it became quickly the fastest growing part of Stevie Ray's.
Oh.
Yes. It's now about half of what our organization is.
Okay.
And that's what I spend 90% of my time doing is workshops and keynotes and things like that.
Sure.
Teaching these skills for the work world.
Nice.
But now it's completely changed. If you say improv in the work world, everybody knows what you're talking about. It's a common training tool.
Yeah. Well, and most likely the one in 10 has gone through the improv, you know, training.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some companies I know of actually have in-house improv troupes that they maintain in-house because they are called upon for brainstorming and problem solving.
Oh, that's an excellent idea. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's a constant source of new ideas.
Yeah, makes sense.
And in my training, what surprised me is that brainstorming skills are one of the least requested offerings that I get called for. Most of the time, it's communicating in tough situations.
Yeah,
presenting to clients, professional networking, which is difficult for a lot of people, and managing teams. So it fits all of those needs.
Yeah. And I had one of our listeners talk to me about being an introvert and experiencing a lot of social anxiety. Do you have any tips for that person?
Yes. First, and I mean, we had one person come to us who was diagnosed agoraphobic.
Okay.
So afraid of the outdoors.
Wow.
Living at home on disability because he couldn't keep a job.
Yeah.
A year and a half into improv training, his therapist told him to take an improv course that would help him.
Yeah.
So he came to us.
Okay.
And Pamela happened to be his instructor. And so she kind of took him under her wing and guided him along. A year and a half later, he was performing improv in front of 300 people at a recital.
Oh.
It was incredible.
That is incredible.
But one of the things we realized is, one, to change one's attitude about being who you are is first and foremost.
Yeah.
And that is, stop calling introvert as a negative thing.
Right.
When somebody says, oh, I'm such an introvert. Yes, you are. And somebody else is an extrovert. And we're not all supposed to be the same kind of person. An introvert is very often exhibiting a high level of intelligence.
Right.
Because they're listening.
Mm-hmm.
Listening takes more brain power than speaking does because it's a harder activity and it requires reading the other person's nonverbal signals, which is a lot of brain power,
yeah.
Discerning meaning behind words instead of through the words,
mm-hmm.
and absorbing information. That's a lot of brain work.
Yeah.
So if you're an introvert and you listen a lot, you're likely more intelligent,
yeah.
But you're using more of your brain.
Yeah.
And also, there's nothing wrong with being shy. That what's wrong with that? Unless you don't like what's happening in your life, well, then you have to change it.
Yeah. Well, this person was saying that she is almost feeling paralyzed.
That's a problem, obviously. But first and foremost is accepting who you are and saying, what I am is fine. I'm just going to add to what I am. I'm not going to change and get rid of, quote, a problem, end quote.
Yeah.
It is adding to the skills I have. So when we work with folks like that, it is using the techniques of listening and adding on.
Yeah.
A lot of times people are uncomfortable in social situations because they tell themselves before they even get there, I don't know what to say.
Right.
When people talk to me, I freeze up.
Yes.
You actually don't freeze up. Your brain always has a response because that's what it does. The brain is a fill-in-the-blank organism. The problem is another part of your brain steps in and says, that's not a good enough response, or that's a stupid thing to say.
Yeah.
That's you judging yourself.
Yeah.
You get rid of that. First, there are rules that we follow in improvisation, which actually surprises most people because they think it's completely freeform.
Yeah.
The brain can't handle freeform.
Mm-hmm.
It has to have structure. And one of the lessons, I took Paul Sills' workshop when he was still alive, and he said, creativity is born of structure. You have to have some kind of confinement in order for you to create, or it's just too open-ended.
Yeah.
So the rules are there to help you create more rather than to restrict you. First rule of improv is trust. The two parts of trust, you have to trust yourself, then you can trust your partner. If you don't trust yourself, you're not ever going to let your partner be fully engaged in what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because you will either try to cut them out or control them.
Yeah.
So that's because you don't trust yourself.
Yeah.
So when we work in improv techniques with people who are introverts and questioning themselves, it's a constant reminder that whatever they say is good. It works. It's appropriate. And you use the yes and techniques along with that. That's not easy to do.
No.
If you've had a lifetime of telling yourself that
you're not good enough.
You're not good enough.
Yeah, you don't sound good. You're never delivering on
exactly.
the material and the situation.
And once they get past that, once they learn that whatever the other person says to them, they have the ability to yes and it and add to it.
Yeah.
Even if they don't know what is being discussed. If somebody's talking about car repair and you know nothing about automobiles.
Yeah.
You can yes and that. You know, hey man, I got this 67 Chevy. Man, is it nice? It is so sweet. Really? Why? That's a yes and.
Exactly.
What about it? Oh, well, it goes 0 to 60 in 100 minutes or whatever, and it's got 1,000 horsepower.
Yeah.
Oh, now what's that compared to a regular car? I don't have to know what you're talking about. All I have to do is keep you talking.
Yeah.
And pretty soon you start absorbing this stuff. And you realize you've gotten through an entire conversation without thinking about yourself.
Yeah.
That's what creates panic. As long as you focus on the other person, you are no longer a problem.
Right. Exactly.
If you sit there and say, oh, I don't know what to say, well, now your brain believes that. And it will not say anything.
Right.
So a lot of improv training for social purposes is to stop thinking about yourself and stop thinking in the first place and just react. Just go.
Yeah.
And that's what having a class is good for, because it makes it a practicable skill before you get into a social or professional situation.
Hmm.
If you just think about doing better the next time you're out there, it won't happen.
Yeah.
Psychologists identify three steps to changing human behavior, and that's awareness, commitment, and practice.
Yeah.
Be aware of it first, commit to doing something, but then you have to practice in a safe environment.
Yeah.
Before you go do it. Many people don't get a chance to do that. Because where are they going to do it?
Yeah.
That's why this guy did so well overcoming his agoraphobia, is he was in an environment where every single thing he said was right. And that's the rule of an improv class. You can debate. That doesn't mean you're wrong. It means you're disagreed with. That's two entirely different things.
Yeah, I can see that. Interesting. Well, we already blew through our time together for our first session.
Oh, okay.
And we've learned a little bit of the history of improv, which is very, very, and I had always associated it with stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And in our next session, if you're up for it, that's a yes.
I have to take a rest. I have to go lay down. I've been talking.
Yes. Relax your vocal cords for a little bit. So our next session, I would like to kind of parallel your history,
mm-hmm.
personal history, with what you shared with us about the improv history.
Okay.
Great. All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. This was an awesome session. Thanks, Stevie, for
Thank
sharing
you.
All. It's always Stevie Ray, isn't it?
Whatever.
Oh, really?
Hey, you works.
Okay. Hey, you. Thanks for being here.
You bet.
All right. See you next time.